"Dead with them," said the buck.
"What, that white-whiskered old bunch? What do we want to know about them?"
"What they did," said Rabscuttle.
"That warlock, old fellow," said the first buck. "That's all finished now. That's got nothing to do with us."
"If this loose-strife fought King What's-His-Name, that's his business," said one of the does. "It's not our business, is it?"
"It was all a very wicked thing," said another doe. "Shameful, really.
If nobody fought in wars, there wouldn't be any, would there? But you can't get old rabbits to see that."
"My father was in it," said the second buck. "He gets on about it sometimes. I always go out quick. They did this, and then we did that, and all that caper. Makes you curl up, honest. Poor old geezer. You'd think he'd want to forget about it. I reckon he makes half of it up. And where did it get him? Tell me that."
"If you don't mind waiting a little while, sir," said a third buck to El Herrera, "I'll go and see if I can find Captain Loosestrife for you. I don't actually know him myself, but then it's rather a big warren."
"That's good of you," said El Herrera, "but I think I've got my bearings now, and I can manage by myself."
El Herrera went along the hedgerow to the wood, and sat alone under a nut bush, looking out across the fields. As the light began to fail, he suddenly realized that Lord Frith was close beside him, among the leaves.
"Are you angry, El Herrera?" asked Lord Frith.
"No, my lord," replied El Herrera. "I am not angry. But I have learned that with creatures one loves, suffering is not the only thing for which one may pity them. A rabbit who does not know when a gift has made him safe is poorer than a slug, even though he may think otherwise himself. Wisdom is found on the desolate hillside, El Herrera, where none comes to feed, and the stony bank where the rabbit scratches a hole in vain. But speaking of gifts, I've brought a few trifles for you. A pair of ears, a tail, and some whiskers. You may find the ears slightly strange at first. I put a little starlight in them, but it is really quite faint. Not enough, I am sure, to give away a clever thief like you."
"Ah, there is Rabscuttle coming back. Good. I've something for him, too. Shall we?"
"Hazel! Hazel Rat!"
It was Pipkin's voice from behind a clump of burdock on the edge of the little circle of listeners.
"There's a fox coming up the coombe!"
Chapter 32. Across the Iron Road. Esprit de rivalité et de mésintelligence. Qui préserva plus d'une fois l'armée anglaise d'une défaite. General Jourdan, Mémoire militaire.
Some people have the idea that rabbits spend a good deal of their time running away from foxes. It is true that every rabbit fears the fox and will bolt if it smells one. But many rabbits go all their lives without seeing a fox, and probably only a few actually fall victim to an enemy who smells strongly and cannot run as fast as they can. A fox trying to catch a rabbit usually creeps upwind under cover, perhaps through a patch of woodland to the edge. Then, if he succeeds in getting close to where the rabbits are at Silfley, along the bank or in the field, he lies still and watches his chance for a quick snatch. It is said that sometimes he fascinates them, as the weasel does, by rolling and playing in the open, coming closer, little by little, until he can make a grab. However this may be, it is certain that no fox hunts rabbits by going openly up a coombe at sunset. Neither Hazel nor any of the rabbits who had been listening to Dandelion's story had ever seen a fox. Nevertheless, they knew that a fox in the open, plain to be seen, is not dangerous as long as it is spotted in time. Hazel realized that he had been careless to allow everyone to gather round Dandelion, and to have failed to post even one sentry. What wind there was from the northeast, and the fox, coming up the coombe from the west, might have broken in upon them without warning. but from this danger they had been saved by Fiver and Pipkin going into the open. Even in his flash of alarm as Pipkin spoke, it crossed Hazel's mind that Fiver, no doubt reluctant to advise him in front of the others, had probably seized the opportunity provided by Pipkin's fear to post himself as a sentry. Hazel thought quickly. If the fox were not too close, all they had to do was run. There was woodland nearby, and they could vanish into it, keeping more or less together, and simply continue on their way. He pushed through the burdocks. "How close is it?" he asked. "And where's Fiver?"
"I'm here,"
replied Fiver, from a few yards away. He was squatting under the long briars of a dog rose, and did not turn his head as Hazel came up beside him.
"And there's the fox,"
he added. Hazel followed his gaze. The rough, weed-covered ground of the coombe sloped away below them. A long dip bounded on the north by Caesar's belt. The last of the setting sun shone straight up it, through a break in the trees. The fox was below them, and still some way off. Although it was almost directly downwind, and therefore must be able to smell them, it did not look as though it were particularly interested in rabbits. It was trotting steadily up the coombe, like a dog trailing its white-tipped brush. In colour it was sandy brown, with dark legs and ears. Even now, though obviously not hunting, it had a crafty, predatory look that made the watchers among the dog roses shiver. As it passed behind a patch of thistles and disappeared from view, Hazel and Fiver returned to the others.
"Come on," said Hazel. "If you've never seen a fox, don't bother to go and look now. Just follow me."
He was about to lead the way up the south side of the coombe, when suddenly a rabbit shouldered him roughly aside, pushed past Fiver, and was gone into the open. Hazel stopped and looked round in amazement.
"Who was that?"
he asked.
"Bigwig,"
answered Fiver, staring. Together they went quickly back to the briars and once more looked into the coombe. Bigwig, in full view, was loping warily downhill, straight toward the fox. They watched him, aghast. He drew near, but still the fox paid no attention.
"Hazel," said Silver from behind.
"Shall I?" "No one is to move,"
said Hazel quickly.
"Keep still, all of you."
At about 30 yards distance, the fox saw the approaching rabbit. It paused for a moment, and then continued to trot forward. It was almost upon him before Bigwig turned and began to limp up the north slope of the coombe toward the trees of the belt. The fox hesitated again and then followed him.
"What's he up to?"
muttered Blackberry.
"Trying to draw it off, I suppose," replied Fiver.
"But he didn't have to. We should have got away without that."
"Confounded fool," said Hazel. "I don't know when I've been so angry."
The fox had quickened its pace and was now some distance away from them. It appeared to be overtaking Bigwig. The sun had set, and in the failing light, they could just make him out as he entered the undergrowth. He disappeared, and the fox followed. For several moments, all was quiet. Then, horribly clear across the darkening, empty coombe, there came the agonizing squeal of a stricken rabbit.
"How frithin' inlay!"
cried Blackberry, stamping. Pipkin turned to bolt. Hazel did not move.
"Shall we go, Hazel?" asked Silver. "We can't help him now."
As he spoke, Bigwig suddenly broke out of the trees, running very fast. Almost before they could grasp that he was alive, he had recrossed the entire upper slope of the coombe in a single dash and bolted in among them.
"Come on," said Bigwig. "Let's get out of here."
"But what, are you wounded?"
asked Bluebell in bewilderment.
"No," said Bigwig. "Never better. Let's go."
"You can wait until I'm ready," said Hazel in a cold, angry tone.
"You've done your best to kill yourself and acted like a complete fool. Now hold your tongue and sit down."
He turned, and although it was rapidly becoming too dark to see any distance, made as though he was still looking out across the coombe. Behind him, the rabbits fidgeted nervously. Several had begun to feel a dreamlike sense of unreality. The long day above ground, the close, overgrown coombe, the frightening story in which they had been absorbed, the sudden appearance of the fox, the shock of Bigwig's inexplicable adventure, all these, following one upon another, had flooded their spirits and left them dull and bemused.
Get them out, Hazel, whispered Fiver, before they all go tharn.
Hazel turned at once.
Well, no fox, he said cheerfully. It's gone, and we'll go too. For goodness sake, keep close together, because if anyone gets lost in the dark, we may not find him again. And remember, if we come upon any strange rabbits, you're to attack them at once and ask questions afterward.
They skirted the side of the wood that lay across the southern edge of the coombe, and then, in ones and twos, slipped across the empty road beyond. Little by little, their spirits cleared. They found themselves in open farmland. Indeed, they could both smell and hear the farm not far away on the evening side, and the going was easy, smooth, wide pasture fields, sloping gently downhill, and divided not by hedges, but by broad, low banks, each as wide as a lane, and overgrown with elder, dogwood, and spindle. It was true rabbit country, reassuring after the belt and the tangled goose-grassed coombe, and when they had covered a good distance over the turf, halting continually to listen and sniff and running, now one and now another, from each piece of cover to the next, Hazel felt safe in giving them a rest. As soon as he had sent out Speedwell and Hawkbit as sentries, he led Bigwig to one side. "I'm angry with you," he said. "You're the one rabbit we're not going to be able to do without, and you have to go and run a silly risk like that. It wasn't necessary, and it wasn't even clever. What were you up to?"
"I'm afraid I just lost my head, Hazel," replied Bigwig. "I've been strung up all day, thinking about this business at Ephrathah. Got me really on edge. When I feel like that, I have to do something, you know? Fight or run a risk. I thought if I could make that fox look a fool, I wouldn't feel so worried about the other thing. What's more, it worked. I feel a lot better now."
"Playing El Herrera," said Hazel. "You duffer. You might have thrown your life away for nothing. We all thought you had. Don't try it again, there's a good chap. You know everything's going to depend on you. But tell me, whatever happened in the trees? Why did you cry like that, if you were all right?"
"I didn't," said Bigwig. "It was very queer what happened. And bad too, I'm afraid. I was going to lose the Homba in the trees, you see, and then come back. Well, I went into the undergrowth, and I just stopped limping and was starting to run really fast, when suddenly I found myself face to face with a bunch of rabbits. Strangers. They were coming toward me, as if they were going out into the open coombe. Of course, I didn't have time to get a good look at them, but they seemed to be big fellows. 'Look out, run,' I said as I dashed up to them, but all they did was try to stop me. One of them said, 'You stay here,' or something like that, and then he got right in my way. So I knocked him down, I had to, and raced off. And the next thing I heard was this dreadful squealing. Of course, I went even faster then, and I got clear of the trees and came back to you."
"So the Homba got this other rabbit?"
"It must have. After all, I led it right onto them, even though I didn't mean to. But I never saw what actually happened."
"What became of the others?"
"I've no idea. They must have run, I suppose."
"I see," said Hazel thoughtfully. "Well, perhaps it's all for the best. But look here, Bigwig, no more fancy tricks until the proper time. There's too much at stake. You'd better stay near Silver and me. We'll keep you in good heart."
At that moment, Silver came up to them. "Hazel," he said, "I've just realized where we are, and it's a lot too close to Ephrathah. I think we ought to make off as soon as we can."
"I want to go right round Ephrathah, wide," said Hazel. "Do you think you can find the way to that iron road Holly told us about?"
"I think so," replied Silver. "But we can't make too big a circle, or they'll be completely exhausted. I can't say I know the way, but I can tell the direction all right."
"Well, we'll just have to take the risk," said Hazel. "If only we can get there by early morning, they can rest at the other end."
They met with no more adventures that night, moving quietly along the edges of the fields under the dim light of a quarter moon. The half-darkness was full of sounds and movement. One sacon put up a plover, which flew round them, calling shrilly, until at length they crossed a bank and left it behind. Soon after, somewhere near them, they heard the unceasing bubbling of a nightjar, a peaceful sound without menace, which died gradually away as they pushed on. And once they heard a corncrake calling as it crept among the long grass of a path verge. It makes a sound like a human fingernail drawn down the teeth of a comb. But Elil they met none, and although they were continually on the watch for signs of an Ephrafin patrol, they saw nothing but mice and a few hedgehogs hunting for slugs along the ditches. At last, as the first lark rose toward the light that was still far up in the sky, Silver, his pale fur sodden dark with dew, came limping back to where Hazel was encouraging Bluebell and Pipkin.
"You can pluck up your spirits, Bluebell," he said. "I think we're close to the Iron Road."
"I wouldn't care about my spirits," said Bluebell, "if my legs weren't so tired. Slugs are lucky not to have legs. I think I'll be a slug."
"Well, I'm a hedgehog," said Hazel,
"so you'd better get on."
"You're not," replied Bluebell. "You haven't enough fleas. Now, slugs don't have fleas either. How comforting to be a slug among the dandelions so snug."
"And feel the blackbird's sudden tug," said Hazel.
"All right, Silver, we're coming.
But where is the Iron Road? Holly said a steep, overgrown bank. I can't make out anything like that."
"No, that's the way up by Ephrafa. Down here it runs in a sort of coombe of its own. Can't you smell it?" Hazel sniffed. In the cool damp, he picked up at once the unnatural smells of metal, coal smoke, and oil. They went forward, and in a very short time found themselves looking down from among the bushes and undergrowth on the edge of the railway cutting. All was quiet, but as they paused at the top of the bank, a tussling pack of six or seven sparrows flew down to the line and began to peck about between the sleepers. Somehow, the sight was reassuring.
"Are we to cross, Hazel-Rah?"
asked Blackberry.
"Yes,"
said Hazel.
"At once. Put it between us and Ephrafa. Then we'll feed."
They went rather hesitantly down into the cutting, half expecting the fiery, thundering angel of Frith to appear out of the twilight. But the silence remained unbroken. Soon they were all feeding in the meadow beyond, too tired to pay attention to concealment, or to anything but the ease of resting their legs and nibbling the grass. From above the larches, Kahar sailed down among them, alighted and folded his long, pale grey wings.
"Mr. Hazel, what you do? You no stay here?"
"They're tired out, Kahar. They've got to have a rest."
"Is not to rest here. Is rabbits come?"
"Yes, but not just yet. We can..."
Yeah, he's coming for find you. He's close."
"Oh, curse these confounded patrols," cried Hazel. "Come on, all of you, get down the field into that wood. Yes, you too, Speedwell, unless you want to have your ears chewed off in Ephrafa. Come on, move."
They tottered over the pasture to the woodland beyond and lay completely exhausted on flat, bare ground under fir trees. Hazel and Fiver consulted Kahar again.
"It's no good expecting them to go any further, Kahar," said Hazel. "They've been going all night, you know. We'll have to sleep here today. Did you actually see a patrol?"
Yeah. Come all along by other side, Iron Road. Just in time you go."
"Well, then you saved us. But look, Kahar, could you go and see where they are now? If they're gone, I'm going to tell our lot to go to sleep. Not that they need telling. Look at them."
Kahar returned with the news that the Ephrafin patrol had turned back without crossing the Iron Road. Then he offered to keep watch himself until the evening, and Hazel, greatly relieved, at once told the rabbits to sleep. One or two had already fallen asleep, lying on their sides on the open ground. Hazel wondered whether he ought to wake them and tell them to get under thicker cover, but as he was thinking about it, he fell asleep himself. The day came on hot and still. Among the trees, the wood pigeons called drowsily, and from time to time, a late cuckoo stammered. In the fields, nothing moved, except the constantly swishing tails of the cows gathered flank to flank in the shade. Chapter 33. The Great River. Never in his life had he seen a river before, this sleek, sinuous, full-bodied animal. All was a shake and a shiver, glints and gleams and sparkles, rustle and swirl, chatter and bubble. Kenneth Graham, The Wind in the Willows. When Hazel woke, he started up at once, for the air around him was full of the sharp cries of some creature hunting. He looked quickly round, but could see no signs of alarm. It was evening. Several of the rabbits were already awake and feeding on the edge of the wood. He realized that the cries, urgent and startling though they were too small and shrill for any kind of Elil. They came from above his head. A bat flittered through the trees and out again without touching a twig. It was followed by another. Hazel could sense that there were many all about, taking flies and moths on the wing and uttering their minute cries as they flew. A human ear would hardly have heard them, but to the rabbits, the air was full of their calls. Outside the wood, the field was still bright with evening sunshine, but among the firs, the light was dusky, and here the bats were coming and going thickly. Mixed with the resinous scent of the firs, there came another smell, strong and fragrant, yet sharp. The perfume of flowers, but of some kind unknown to Hazel. He followed it to its source at the edge of the wood. It came from several thick patches of soapwort growing along the edge of the pasture. Some of the plants were not yet in bloom, their buds curled in pink, pointed spirals held in the pale green calyces, but most were already star-flowering and giving off their strong scent. The bats were hunting among the flies and moths attracted to the soapwort. Hazel passed Hraka and began to feed in the field. He was disturbed to find that his hind leg was troubling him. He had thought that it was healed, but the forced journey over the downs had evidently proved too much for the muscle torn by the shotgun pellets. He wondered whether it was far to the river of which Kihar had spoken. If it was, he was in for trouble.
"Hazel Ra,"
said Pipkin, coming up from among the soapwort.
"Are you all right? Your leg looks queer. You're dragging it."
"No, it's all right," said Hazel. "Look here, Roo. Where's Kihar? I want to talk to him."
"He's flown out to see if there's a patrol anywhere near, Hazel Ra. Bigwig woke some time ago, and he and Silver asked Kihar to go. They didn't want to disturb you."
Hazel felt irritated. It would have been better to be told at once which way to go, rather than to wait while Kihar looked for patrols. They were going to cross a river, and, as far as he was concerned, they could not do it too soon. Fretting, he waited for Kihar. Soon, he had become as tense and nervous as he had ever been in his life. He was beginning to believe that, after all, he might have been rash. It was clear that Holly had not underrated their danger near Ephrathah. He had little doubt that Bigwig, by sheer chance, had led the fox onto a wide patrol, which had been following their trail. Then, in the morning, again by luck and the help of Kihar, they had evidently just missed another at the crossing of the Iron Road. Perhaps Silver's fear was well-founded, and a patrol had already spotted and reported them without their knowing. Had General Woundwort got some sort of Kihar of his own? Perhaps a bat was at this moment talking to him. How was one to foresee and guard against everything? The grass seemed sour, the sunshine chilly. Hazel sat hunched under the firs, worrying dismally. He felt less annoyed now with Bigwig. He could understand his feelings. Waiting was bad. He fidgeted for some kind of action. Just as he had decided to wait no longer, but to collect everyone and go immediately, Kihar came flying from the direction of the cutting. He flapped clumsily down among the firs, silencing the bats.
"Mr. Hazel, is no rabbits. I think maybe they no like for go across Iron Road."
"Good. Is it far to the river, Kihar?"
Nah, it's close, in wood."
"Splendid. We can find this crossing in daylight?"
Yeah, I show you bridge."
The rabbits had gone only a short distance through the wood when they sensed that they were already near the river. The ground became soft and damp. They could smell sedge and water. Suddenly, the harsh, vibrating cry of a moorhen echoed through the trees, followed by a flapping of wings and a watery scuttering. The rustling of the leaves seemed also to echo, as though reflected distantly from hard ground. A little further on, they could distinctly hear the water itself, the low, continuous pouring of a shallow fall. A human being, hearing from a distance the noise of a crowd, can form an idea of its size. The sound of the river told the rabbits that it must be bigger than any they had known before, wide, smooth, and swift. Pausing among the comfrey and ground elder, they stared at each other, seeking reassurance. Then they began to lollop hesitantly forward into more open ground. There was still no river to be seen, but in front they could perceive a flicker and dance of mirrored light in the air. Soon afterward, Hazel, limping ahead with Fiver near him, found himself on a narrow green path that divided the wilderness from the riverbank. The path was almost as smooth as a lawn and clear of bushes and weeds, for it was kept cut for fishermen. Along its further side, the riparian plants grew thickly, so that it was separated from the river by a kind of hedge of purple loosestrife, great willow herb, fleabane, figwort, and hemp agrimony, here and there already in bloom. Two or three more of the rabbits emerged from the wood. Peering through the plant clumps, they could catch glimpses of the smooth, glittering river, evidently much wider and swifter than the Enborn. Although there was no enemy or other danger to be perceived, they felt the apprehension and doubt of those who have come unawares upon some awe-inspiring place, where they themselves are paltry fellows of no account. When Marco Polo came at last to Cathay, 700 years ago, did he not feel, and did his heart not falter as he realized, that this great and splendid capital of an empire had had its being all the years of his life, and far longer, and that he had been ignorant of it? That it was in need of nothing from him, from Venice, from Europe, that it was full of wonders beyond his understanding, that his arrival was a matter of no importance whatever. We know that he felt these things, and so has many a traveller in foreign parts who did not know what he was going to find. There is nothing that cuts you down to size, like coming to some strange and marvellous place where no one even stops to notice that you stare about you. The rabbits were uneasy and confused. They crouched on the grass, sniffing the water smells in the cooling sunset air, and moved closer together, each hoping not to see in the others the nervousness he felt in himself. As Pipkin reached the path, a great shimmering dragonfly, 4 inches long, all emerald and sable, appeared at his shoulder, hovered, droning and motionless, and was gone, like lightning into the sedge. Pipkin leaped back in alarm. As he did so, there came a shrill, vibrant cry, and he caught sight, between the plants, of a brilliant azure bird flashing past over the open water. A few moments later there came, from close behind the plant hedge, the sound of a fairly heavy splash, but what creature might have made it, there was no telling. Looking round for Hazel, Pipkin caught sight of Kahar, a little way off, standing in a patch of shallow water between 2 clumps of willow herb. He was stabbing and snapping at something in the mud, and after a few moments pulled out a 6-inch leech and swallowed it whole. Beyond him, some distance down the path, Hazel was combing the goose grass out of his coat and evidently listening to Fiver as they sat together under a rhododendron. Pipkin ran along the bank and joined them.
"There's nothing wrong with the place," Fiver was saying. "There's no more danger here than anywhere else. Kahar's going to show us where to get across, isn't he? The thing to do is to get on with it before it gets dark."
"They'll never stop here," replied Hazel. "We can't stay and wait for Bigwig in a place like this. It's unnatural for rabbits."
"Yes, we can. Calm down. They'll get used to it quicker than you think. I tell you, it's better than 1 or 2 other places we've been in. Not all strange things are bad. Would you like me to take them over? Say it's because of your leg."
"Fine," said Hazel. "Clearoo, can you get everyone along here?"
When Pipkin had gone, he said,
"I feel troubled, Fiver. I'm asking so much of them, and there are so many risks in this plan." "They're a better lot than you give them credit for," replied Fiver. "If you were to—"
Kahar called raucously across, startling a wren out of the bushes. "Mr. Hazel, what for you wait?"
"To know where to go,"
answered Fiver.
"Bridge near. You go on, you see."
Where they were, The undergrowth stood close to the green path, but beyond, downstream, as they all intuitively felt, it gave way to open parkland. Out into this they went, Hazel following Fiver. Hazel did not know what a bridge was. It was another of Kihar's unknown words that he did not feel up to questioning. Despite his trust in Kihar and his respect for his wide experience, he felt still more disturbed as they came into the open. Clearly this was some sort of man-place, frequented and dangerous. A short way ahead was a road. He could see its smooth, unnatural surface stretching away over the grass. He stopped and looked at it. At length, when he was sure that there were no men anywhere near, he went cautiously up to the verge. The road crossed the river on a bridge about 30 feet long. It did not occur to Hazel that there was anything unusual in this. The idea of a bridge was beyond him. He saw only a line of stout posts and rails on either side of the road. Similarly, simple African villagers who have never left their remote homes may not be particularly surprised by their first sight of an airplane. It is outside their comprehension. But their first sight of a horse pulling a cart will set them pointing and laughing at the ingenuity of the fellow who thought of that one. Hazel saw without surprise the road crossing the river. What worried him was that where it did so, there were only very narrow verges of short grass offering no cover. His rabbits would be exposed to view and unable to bolt except along the road.
"Do you think we can risk it, Fiver?"
he asked.
"I can't see why you're bothered," answered Fiver. "You went into the farmyard and the shed where the hutch rabbits were. This is much less dangerous. Come on. They're all watching while we hesitate."
Fiver hopped out on the road. He looked round for a moment and then made his way to the nearer end of the bridge. Hazel followed him along the verge, keeping close beside the rail on the upstream side. Looking round, he saw Pipkin close behind. In the middle of the bridge, Fiver, who was perfectly calm and unhurried, stopped and sat up. The other two joined him.
"Let's put on a bit of an act," said Fiver. "Make them inquisitive. They'll follow us just to see what we're looking at."
There was no sill along the edge of the bridge. They could have walked off it, into the water 3 feet below. From under the lowest rail, they looked out, upstream, and now, for the first time, saw the whole river plainly. If the bridge had not startled Hazel, the river did. He remembered the Enbourne, its surface broken by gravel spits and plant growth. The Test, a weed-cut, carefully tended trout stream, seemed to him like a world of water. A good 10 yards wide it was, fast-flowing and smooth, spangling and dazzling in the evening sun. The tree reflections on the even current were unbroken as on a lake. There was not a reed or a plant to be seen above the water. Close by, under the left bank, a bed of crowfoot trailed downstream, the wheel-like leaves all submerged. Darker still, almost black, were the mats of water moss, their thick masses motionless on the bed of the river, and only the trailing fronds waving slowly from side to side. Waving, too, were the wider expanses of pale green cressweed, but these rippled with the current, lightly and quickly. The water was very clear, with a bed of clean yellow gravel, and even in the middle was hardly 4 feet deep. As the rabbits stared down, they could discern here and there a very fine scour, like smoke, chalk and powdered gravel carried along by the river as dust is blown on the wind. Suddenly, from under the bridge, with a languid movement of its flat tail, swam a gravel-coloured fish as long as a rabbit. The watchers, immediately above, could see the dark, vivid spots along its sides. Warily it hung in the current below them, undulating from side to side. It reminded Hazel of the cat in the yard. As they stared, it swam upward, with a lithe flicker, and stopped just below the surface. A moment later its blunt nose thrust clear of the stream, and they saw the open mouth, pure white inside. Rhythmically, without haste, it sucked down a floating sedge fly and sank back underwater. A ripple spread outward in subsiding circles, breaking both the reflections and the transparency. Gradually, the stream grew smooth, and once more they saw the fish below them, waving its tail as it hailed its place in the current.
"A water hawk,"
said Fiver.
"So they hunt and eat down there too. Don't fall in, Clairoux. Remember El Herrera and the pike."
"Would it eat me?"
asked Pipkin, staring. "There may be creatures in there that could," said Hazel. "How do we know? Come on, let's get across. What would you do if a Rududu came?"
"Run,"
said Fiver simply.
"Like this."
And he scurried off the further end of the bridge into the grass beyond. On this far side of the river, undergrowth and a grove of great horse chestnuts extended almost down to the bridge. The ground was marshy, but at least there was plenty of cover. Fiver and Pipkin began at once on some scrapes, while Hazel sat chewing pellets and resting his injured leg. Soon they were joined by Silver and Dandelion, but the other rabbits, more hesitant even than Hazel, remained crouching in the long grass on the right bank. At last, just before darkness fell, Fiver recrossed the bridge and coaxed them to follow him back. Bigwig, to everyone's surprise, showed considerable reluctance, and only crossed in the end after Kahar, returning from another flight over Ephrafa, had asked whether he would like him to go and fetch a fox. The night that followed seemed to all of them disorganized and precarious. Hazel, still conscious of being in man country, was half expecting either a dog or a cat. But although they heard owls more than once, no Elil attacked them, and by the morning they were in better spirits. As soon as they had fed, Hazel set them to exploring the surroundings. It became even more plain that the ground near the river was too wet for rabbits. Indeed, in places it was almost bog. Marsh sedge grew there, pink sweet-scented valerian and the drooping water avens. Silver reported that it was drier up in the woodland away from the bank, and at first Hazel had the idea of picking a fresh spot and digging again. But presently the day grew so hot and humid that all activity was quenched. The faint breeze vanished. The sun drew up a torpid moisture from the watery thickets. The smell of water mint filled all the hydrophenic air. The rabbits crept into the shade under any cover that offered. Long before Nefrith, all were drowsing in the undergrowth. It was not until the dappled afternoon began to grow cool that Hazel woke suddenly to find Kahar beside him. The gull was strutting from side to side with short, quick steps and pecking impatiently in the long grass. Hazel sat up quickly.
"What is it, Kahar? Not a patrol."
"Nah, nah. It's all fine for sleep like bloody owls. Maybe I go for pig water. Mr. Hazel, you getting mothers now soon? What for wait now?"
"No, you're right, Kahar. We must start now. The trouble is, I can see how to start, but not how to finish."
Hazel made his way through the grass, roused the first rabbit he found, who happened to be Bluebell, and sent him to fetch Bigwig, Blackberry, and Fiver. When they came, he took them to join Kahar on the short grass of the riverbank.
"This is the problem, Blackberry," he said. "You remember that when we were under the down that evening, I said we should have to do three things. Get the does out of Ephrafa, break up the pursuit, and then get right away so that they wouldn't find us. This plan you've thought up is clever. It'll do the first two things all right, I'm sure of that. But what about the last one? The Ephrafin rabbits are fast and savage. They'll find us if we're to be found, and I don't believe we can run away faster than they can follow, especially with a lot of does who've never been out of Ephrafa. We couldn't possibly stand and fight them to a finish. We're too few. And on top of that, my leg seems to be bad again. So what's to be done?"
"I don't know," answered Blackberry. "But obviously, we shall need to disappear. Could we swim the river?
No scent then, you know."
"It's too swift," said Hazel. "We'd be carried away. But even if we did swim it, we couldn't count on not being followed. From what I've heard of these Ephrafans, they'd certainly swim the river if they thought we had. What it comes to is that, with Kahar to help us, we can break up a pursuit while we're getting the does out, but they'll know which way we've gone,
and they won't leave it at that. No, you're right. We've got to vanish without a trace, so that they can't even track us. But how?
I don't know, said Blackberry again. Shall we go up the river a little way and have a look at it? Perhaps there's somewhere we could use for a hiding place. Can you manage that with your leg?
If we don't go too far, replied Hazel.
Can I come, Hazel Ra?
Asked Bluebell, who had been waiting about a little way off.
Yes, all right, said Hazel good-naturedly, as he began to limp along the bank upstream.
They soon realized that the woodland on this left bank was lonely, thick and overgrown, denser than the nut copses and bluebell woods of Sandalford. Several times they heard the drumming of a great woodpecker, the shyest of birds. As Blackberry was suggesting that perhaps they might look for a hiding place somewhere in this jungle, they became aware of another sound, the falling water which they had heard on their approach the day before. Soon they reached a place where the river curved round in a bend from the east, and here they came upon the broad, shallow fall. It was no more than a foot high, one of those artificial falls common on the chalk streams made to attract trout. Several were already rising to the evening hatch of fly. Just above the fall, a plank footbridge crossed the river. Kahar flew up, circled the pool, and perched on the handrail.
"This is more sheltered and lonely than the bridge we crossed last night," said Blackberry. "Perhaps we could make some use of it. You didn't know about this bridge, Kahar, did you?"
"Nah, not know, not see him, but this good bridge, no one come."
"I'd like to go across, Hazel Ra," said Blackberry.
"Well, Fiver's the rabbit for that," replied Hazel. "He simply loves crossing bridges. You carry on. I'll come behind with Bigwig and Bluebell here."
The five rabbits hopped slowly along the planks, their great sensitive ears full of the sound of the falling water. Hazel, who was not sure of his footing, had to stop several times. When at length he reached the further side, he found that Fiver and Blackberry had already gone a little way downstream, below the fall, and were looking at some large object sticking out from the bank. At first he thought that it must be a fallen tree trunk, but as he came closer he saw that although it was certainly wooden, it was not round, but flat, or nearly flat, with raised edges, some man-thing. He remembered how once, long ago, sniffing over a farm rubbish heap with Fiver, he had come upon a similar object, large, smooth, and flat. That had, in fact, been an old, discarded door. It had been of no use to them, and they had left it alone. His inclination was to leave this alone, too. One end of the thing was pressed into the bank, but along its length it diverged, sticking out slightly into the stream. There were ripples round it, for under the banks the current was as swift as in midstream, on account of weed cutting and sound camp sheeting. As Hazel came nearer, he saw that Blackberry had actually scrambled on the thing. His claws made a faint hollow sound on the wood, so there must be water underneath. Whatever it might be, the thing did not extend downward to the bottom. It was lying on the water.
"What are you after, Blackberry?" he said rather sharply.
"Food," replied Blackberry. "Flavor, can't you smell it?"
Kahar had alighted on the middle of the thing and was snapping away at something white. Blackberry scuttered along the wood toward him and began to nibble at some kind of green stuff. After a little while, Hazel also ventured out on the wood and sat in the sunshine, watching the flies on the warm, varnished surface and sniffing the strange river smells that came up from the water.
"What is this man-thing, Kahar?" he asked. "Is it dangerous?"
"Nah, no dangerous. You not know? Is pot. At peak water is many, many pot. Men make them, go on water, is no harm."
Kahar went on pecking at the broken pieces of stale bread. Blackberry, who had finished the fragments of lettuce he had found, was sitting up and looking over the very low side, watching a stone-coloured, black-spotted trout swim up into the fall. The boat was a miniature punt used for reed-cutting, little more than a raft, with a single thwart amidships. Even when it was unmanned as now, There were only a few inches of free board.
"You know,"
said Fiver from the bank,
"seeing you sitting there reminds me of that other wooden thing you found when the dog was in the wood and you got Pipkin and me over the river. Do you remember?"
"I remember shoving you along," said Bigwig. "It was jolly cold."
"What puzzles me," said Blackberry, "is why this boat thing doesn't go along. Everything in this river goes along, and fast, too. See there?"
He looked out at a piece of stick floating down on the even 2-mile-an-hour current.
"So what's stopping this thing from going?"
Gehar had a short way with landlubber's manner, which he sometimes used to those of the rabbits that he did not particularly like. Blackberry was not one of his favourites. He preferred straightforward characters such as Bigwig, Buckthorn, and Silver.
"Is rope, you like bite him? Dem you go damn quick all the way."
"Yes, I see," said Fiver. "The rope goes round that metal thing where Hazel's sitting, and the other end's fixed on the bank here. It's like the stalk of a big leaf. You could gnaw it through, and the leaf, the boat, would drop off the bank."
"Well, anyway, let's go back now," said Hazel, rather dejectedly. "I'm afraid we don't seem to be any nearer to finding what we're looking for, Kehar. Can you possibly wait until tomorrow? I had the idea that we might all move to somewhere a bit drier before tonight, higher up in the wood, away from the river."
"Oh, what a pity," said Bluebell. "Do you know, I'd quite decided to become a water rabbit."
"Oh, what?"
asked Bigwig.
"A water rabbit," repeated Bluebell. "Well, there are water rats and water beetles, and Pipkin says that last night he saw a water hawk. So why not a water rabbit? I shall float merrily along."
"Great golden frith on a hill," cried Blackberry suddenly. "Great jumping rabscuttle! That's it, Bluebell! You shall be a water rabbit."
He began leaping and skipping about on the bank and cuffing Fiver with his front paws.
"Don't you see, Fiver? Don't you see? We bite the rope, and off we go! And General Woundwort doesn't know."
Fiver paused.
"Yes, I do see," he replied at length. "You mean on the boat? I must say, Blackberry, you're a clever fellow. I remember now that after we'd crossed that other river, you said that that floating trick might come in handy again sometime."
"Here, wait a moment," said Hazel. "We're just simple rabbits, Bigwig and I. Do you mind explaining?"
Then and there, while the black gnats settled on their ears by the plank bridge and the pouring waterfall, Blackberry and Fiver explained.
"Could you just go and try the rope, Hazel Ra?"
added Blackberry when he had finished.
"It may be too thick."
They went back to the punt.
"No, it's not," said Hazel. "And it's stretched tight, of course, which makes it much easier to gnaw. I can gnaw that, all right."
"Yeah, it's good," said Gehar. "You go fine, but you do him quick, yeah? Maybe something change. Ma'am come, take port, you know?"
"There's nothing more to wait for," said Hazel.
"Go on, Bigwig, straight away, and may Elereira go with you. And remember, you're the leader now. Send word by Kahar what you want us to do. We shall all be here, ready to back you up."
Afterward, they all remembered how Bigwig had taken his orders. No one could say that he did not practice what he preached. He hesitated a few moments and then looked squarely at Hazel.
"It's sudden," he said. "I wasn't expecting it tonight. But that's all to the good. I hated waiting. See you later." He touched his nose to Hazel's, turned, and hopped away into the undergrowth. A few minutes later, guided by Kehar, he was running up the open pasture north of the river, straight for the brick arch in the overgrown railway embankment and the fields that lay beyond.
Chapter 34. General Woundwort. Like an obelisk towards which the principal streets of a town converge, the strong will of a proud spirit stands prominent and commanding in the middle of the art of war. Close of it's on war. Dusk was falling on Ephrafah. In the failing light, General Woundwort was watching the near hind mark at Silfley, along the edge of the great pasture field that lay between the warren and the iron road. Most of the rabbits were feeding near the mark holes,
which were close beside the field, concealed among the trees and undergrowth, bordering a lonely bridle path. A few, however, had ventured out into the field to browse and play in the last of the sun. Further out still were the sentries of the Ausla, on the alert for the approach of men or Elil, and also for any rabbit who might stray too far to be able to get underground quickly if there should be an alarm. Captain Chervil, one of the two officers of the mark, had just returned from a round of his sentries and was talking to some of the does near the centre of the mark ground when he saw the general approaching. He looked quickly about to see whether anything was at fault. Since all seemed to be well, he began nibbling at a patch of sweet vernal with the best air of indifference that he could manage. General Woundwort was a singular rabbit. Some 3 years before, he had been born, the strongest of a litter of five, in a burrow outside a cottage garden near Coal Hindley. His father, a happy-go-lucky and reckless buck, had thought nothing of living close to human beings, except that he would be able to forage in their garden in the early morning. He had paid dearly for his rashness. After 2 or 3 weeks of spoiled lettuces and nibbled cabbage plants, the cottager had lain in wait and shot him as he came through the potato patch at dawn. The same morning, the man set to work to dig out the doe and her growing litter. Woundwort's mother escaped, racing across the kale field toward the downs, her kittens doing their best to follow her. None but Woundwort succeeded. His mother, bleeding from a shotgun pellet, made her way along the hedges in broad daylight, with Woundwort limping beside her. It was not long before a weasel picked up the scent of the blood and followed it. The little rabbit cowered in the grass while his mother was killed before his eyes. He made no attempt to run, but the weasel, its hunger satisfied, left him alone and made off through the bushes. Several hours later, a kind old schoolmaster from Overton, walking through the fields, came upon Woundwort, nuzzling the cold, still body and crying. He carried him home to his own kitchen and saved his life, feeding him with milk from a nasal dropper until he was old enough to eat bran and green stuff. But Woundwort grew up very wild, and like Cooper's hare, would bite when he could. In a month he was big and strong and had become savage. He nearly killed the schoolmaster's cat, which had found him at liberty in the kitchen, and tried to torment him. One night, a week later, he tore the wire from the front of his hutch and escaped to the open country. Most rabbits in his situation, lacking almost all experience of wildlife, would have fallen victim at once to the Elil, but not Woundwort. After a few days wandering, he came upon a small warren, and snarling and clawing, forced them to accept him. Soon he became chief rabbit, having killed both the previous chief and a rival named Firin. In combat, he was terrifying, fighting entirely to kill, indifferent to any wounds he received himself, and closing with his adversaries until his weight overbore and exhausted them. Those who had no heart to oppose him were not long in feeling that here was a leader indeed. Woundwort was ready to fight anything except a fox. One evening, he attacked and drove off a foraging Aberdeen puppy. He was impervious to the fascination of the Mustelidae, and hoped someday to kill a weasel, if not a stoat. When he had explored the limits of his own strength, he set to work to satisfy his longing for still more power in the only possible way, by increasing the power of the rabbits about him. He needed a bigger kingdom. Men were the great danger, but this could be circumvented by cunning and discipline. He left the small warren, taking his followers with him, and set out to look for a place suited to his purpose, where the very existence of rabbits could be concealed and extermination made very difficult. Ephrafa grew up round the crossing point of two green bridle paths, one of which, the east-west, was tunnel-like, bordered on both sides by a thick growth of trees and bushes. The immigrants, under Wundwurt's direction, dug their holes between the roots of the trees, in the undergrowth and along the ditches. From the first, the warren prospered. Wundwurt watched over them with a tireless zeal that won their loyalty even while they feared him. When the does stopped digging, Wundwurt himself went on with their work while they slept. If a man was coming, Wundwurt spotted him half a mile away. He fought rats, magpies, grey squirrels, and once a crow. When litters were kindled, he kept an eye on their growth, picked out the strongest youngsters for the Ausla, and trained them himself. He would allow no rabbit to leave the warren. Quite early on, three who tried to do so were hunted down and forced to return. As the warren grew, so Wundwurt developed his system to keep it under control. Crowds of rabbits feeding at morning and evening were likely to attract attention. He devised the marks, each controlled by his own officers and sentries, with feeding times changed regularly to give all a share of early morning and sunset, the favoured hours for Silfley. All signs of rabbit life were concealed as closely as possible. The Ausla had privileges in regard to feeding, mating, and freedom of movement. Any failure of duty on their part was liable to be punished by demotion and loss of privileges. For ordinary rabbits, the punishments were more severe. When it was no longer possible for Wundwurt to be everywhere, the council was set up. Some of the members came from the Ausla, but others were selected solely for their loyalty or their cunning as advisers. Old Snowdrop was growing deaf, but no one knew more than he about organizing a warren for safety. On his advice, the runs and burrows of the various marks were not connected underground, so that disease or poison, if they came, would spread less readily. Conspiracy would also spread less readily. To visit the burrows of another mark was not allowed without an officer's permission. It was on Snowdrop's advice, too, that Wundwurt at length ordered that the warren was not to extend further on account of the risk of detection and the weakening of central control. He was persuaded only with difficulty, for the new policy frustrated his restless desire of power after power. This now needed another outlet, and soon after the warren had been stopped from growing, he introduced the wide patrols. The wide patrols began as mere forays or raids, led by Wundwurt into the surrounding country. He would simply pick four or five of the Ausla and take them out to look for trouble. On the first occasion, they were lucky enough to find and kill a sick owl that had eaten a mouse that had eaten poison-dressed seed corn. On the next, they came upon two Hlesel, whom they compelled to return with them to join the warren. Wundwurt was no mere bully. He knew how to encourage other rabbits and to fill them with a spirit of emulation. It was not long before his officers were asking to be allowed to lead patrols. Wundwurt would give them tasks, to search for Hlesel in a certain direction, or to find out whether a particular ditch or barn contained rats which could later be attacked in force and driven out. Only from farms and gardens were they ordered to keep clear. One of these patrols, led by a certain Captain Orcus, discovered a small warren 2 miles to the east, beyond the King's Clear Overton Road, on the outskirts of Nutley Copse. The general led an expedition against it and broke it up, the prisoners being brought back to Ephrafa, where a few of them later rose to be Ausla members themselves. As the months went on, the wide patrols became systematic. During summer and early autumn, there were usually two or three out at a time. There came to be no other rabbits for a long way round Ephrafa, and any who might wander into the neighbourhood by chance were quickly picked up. Casualties in the wide patrols were high, for the Elil got to know that they went out. Often it would take all a leader's courage and skill to complete his task and bring his rabbits, or some of his rabbits, back to the warren. But the Ausla were proud of the risks they ran, and besides, Wundworth was in the habit of going out himself to see how they were getting on. A patrol leader, more than a mile from Ephrafa, limping up a hedgerow in the rain, would come upon the general, squatting like a hare under a tussock of darnel, and find himself required, then and there, to report what he had been doing or why he was off his route. The patrols were the training grounds of cunning trackers, swift runners, and fierce fighters. And the casualties, although there might be as many as 5 or 6 in a bad month, suited Wundworth's purpose, for numbers needed keeping down, and there were always fresh vacancies in the Ausler, which the younger bucks did their best to be good enough to fill. To feel that rabbits were competing to risk their lives at his orders gratified Wundworth, although he believed, and so did his council and his Ausler, that he was giving the war in peace and security at a price which was modest enough. Nevertheless, this evening, as he came out from among the ash trees to talk to Captain Cherville, the general was feeling seriously concerned about several things. It was less and less easy to keep the size of the warren under control. Overcrowding was becoming a grave problem, and this despite the fact that many of the does were reabsorbing their litters before birth. While their doing so was all to the good in itself, some of them were growing restive and hard to manage. Not long ago, a group of does had come before the council and asked to leave the warren. They had been peaceable at first, offering to go as far away as the council wished, but when it had become plain that their request was not going to be granted on any terms, they had become first petulant and then aggressive, and the council had had to take strong measures. There was still a good deal of bad feeling over the business. Then, in the third place, the Ausler had lately lost a certain amount of respect among the rank and file. 4 wandering rabbits, giving themselves out to be some kind of embassy from another warren, had been held and impressed into the right flank mark. He had intended, later, to find out where they had come from. But they had succeeded in playing a very simple trick, bamboozling the mark commander, tacking his sentries and escaping by night. Captain Bugloss, the officer responsible, had, of course, been demoted and expelled from the Ausler, but his disgrace, though very proper, only added to the general's difficulties. The truth was that Ephrafa had become, for the moment, short of good officers. Ordinary Ausler, sentries, were not too hard to find, but officers were another matter, and he had lost 3 in less than a month. Bugloss was as good as a casualty. He would never hold rank again. But worse, Captain Charlock, a brave and resourceful rabbit, while leading the pursuit of the fugitives, had been run down on the iron road by a train. A further proof, if any were needed, of the wicked malice of men. Worst of all, only 2 nights ago, a patrol which had been out to the north had returned with the shocking news that its leader, Captain Mallow, an officer of exceptional prestige and experience, had been killed by a fox. It was an odd business. The patrol had picked up the scent of a fairly large party of rabbits, evidently coming toward Ephrafa from the north. They had been following it, but had not yet sighted their quarry, when suddenly a strange rabbit had burst in upon them as they were nearing the edge of some woodland. They had, of course, tried to stop him, and at that moment the fox, which had apparently been following him closely, had come from the open coombe beyond and killed poor Mallow in an instant. All things considered, the patrol had come away in good order, and Groundsel, the second in command, had done well. But nothing more had been seen of the strange rabbit, and the loss of Mallow, with nothing to show for it, had upset and demoralized the Ausler a good deal. Other patrols had been sent out at once, but all that they had established was that the rabbits from the north had crossed the iron road and disappeared southward. It was intolerable that they should have passed so close to Ephrafa and gone their way without being apprehended. Even now, they might possibly be caught, if only there were a really enterprising officer to put in charge of the search. It would certainly need an enterprising officer, Captain Campion, perhaps, for patrols seldom crossed the Iron Road, and the wet country beyond, the country near the river, was only partly known. He would have gone himself, but with the recent disciplinary troubles in the Warren, he could not take the risk, and Campion could hardly be spared just now. No, infuriating as it was, the strangers were best forgotten for the moment. The first thing was to replace the Ausla losses, and preferably with rabbits who knew how to deal ruthlessly with any further signs of dissension. They would simply have to promote the best they had got, draw their horns in for a time, and concentrate on training until things got back to normal. Wundvoort greeted Captain Chervil rather abstractedly and went on turning the problem over in his mind.
"What are your sentries like, Chervil?" he asked at length. "Do I know any of them?"
"They're a good lot, sir," replied Chervil. "You know Marjoram. He's been on patrol with you as a runner. And I think you know Moneywort."
"Yes, I know them," said Wundvoort. "But they wouldn't make officers. We need to replace Charlock and Mallow. That's what I'm getting at."
"That's difficult, sir," said Chervil. "That sort of rabbit doesn't hop out of the grass."
"Well, they've got to hop from somewhere," said Wundvoort. "You'd better think about it and tell me any ideas that occur to you. Anyway, I want to go around your sentries now. Come with me, will you?" They were about to set off when a third rabbit approached. None other than Captain Campion himself. It was Campion's principal duty to search the outskirts of Ephrafah at morning and evening and to report anything new. The tire marks of a tractor in mud, the droppings of a sparrowhawk, or the spreading of fertilizer on a field. An expert tracker, he missed little or nothing, and was one of the very few rabbits for whom Wundvoort felt a genuine respect.
"You want me?" said Wundvoort, pausing.
"Well, I think so, sir," replied Campion. "We picked up a Hlesy and brought him in."
"Where was he?"
"Down by the arch, sir, just this side of it."
"What was he doing?"
"Well, sir, he says he's come a long way on purpose to join Ephrafah. That's why I thought you might like to see him."
"Wants to join Ephrafah?" asked Wundvoort, puzzled.
"That's what he says, sir."
"Why can't the council see him tomorrow?"
"Just as you like, sir, of course. It strikes me as being a bit out of the ordinary. I'd say a distinctly useful rabbit."
"Hmm," said Wundvoort, considering. "Well, all right. I'm going along, though. Where is he now?"
"At the Crixa, sir."
Campion meant the crossing point of the two bridle paths, which was about 50 yards away among the trees.
"Two of my patrol are with him."
Wundvoort made his way back to the Crixa. Chervil, being on duty with his mark, remained where he was. Campion accompanied the general. At this hour, the Crixa was all green shade, with red gleams of sun that winked through the moving leaves. The damp grass along the edges of the paths was dotted with spikes of mauve bugle, and the sanicles and yellow archangels flowered thickly. Under an elder bush on the far side of the track, two Auslafa, or council police, were waiting, and with them was the stranger. Wundvoort saw at once what Campion had meant. The stranger was a big rabbit, heavy but alert, with a rugged, seasoned appearance and the look of a fighter. He had a curious thick growth of fur, a kind of topknot on the crown of his head. He stared at Wundvoort with a detached, appraising air, which the general had not encountered for a very long time.
"Who are you?" said Wundvoort.
"My name is Thlaley," replied the stranger. "Thlaley, sir," prompted Campion.
The stranger said nothing.
"The patrol brought you in, I'm told. What were you doing?"
"I've come to join Ephrafah."
"Why?"
"I'm surprised you ask. Sure Warren, isn't it? Is there anything odd about someone wanting to join?"
Wundvoort was nonplussed. He was no fool, and it was, he could not help feeling, extremely odd that any right-minded rabbit should choose to walk into Ephrafah of his own accord. But he could hardly say so.
"What can you do?"
"I can run and fight and spoil a story telling it. I've been an officer in an Ausla."
"Fight, can you? Could you fight him?"
said Wundvoort, looking at Campion.
"Certainly, if you wish.
The stranger reared up and aimed a heavy cuff at Campion, who leaped back just in time.
"Don't be a fool," said Wombat. "Sit down. Where were you in Anauxla?"
"Far off. The warren was destroyed by men, but I escaped. I've been